Today's event is very timely, and I'm very pleased to present three incredible panelists to discuss the issues of cybersecurity in U.S.-Taiwan relations. Now, you would have to be living under a rock to not understand the significance of cybersecurity, given all the news reports that are now in the news about the cost, as well as the effects, other effects of cyber attacks and cyber espionage. One of the issues that is most timely and particularly relevant right now is with regards to the hacks of the DNC. And this is actually an experience that is also not unique to the United States, because similarly, Taiwan experienced similar cyber attacks in the lead up to their presidential elections in January. And so, just to lay out a few sort of context here before I our speakers, is that now the range of estimates in terms of the number of hackers that are in the People's Republic of China I've seen from ranging from Taiwan government estimates of 180,000 to more private estimates to 400,000. Now, the cybersecurity firms FireEye, citing 2014 data, places Taiwan in the third place behind South Korea and Hong Kong on the volume of APT, activity in the Asia Pacific region. As I was referencing earlier, however, the data that was compiled by that firm also indicated that between the months of July and December of 2015, there were 60% of FireEye's customers observed attacks of advanced cyber attacks. And so I suspect that probably has something to do with the elections that were pending in Taiwan at that time. Furthermore, cyber attacks have been reportedly on the rise since the new Taiwan administration has been in power. These are all signals of the increasing nature of these challenges that Taiwan faces. And so I'm very pleased to be able to have the panelists here that we've assembled. I really can't think of a better group of expertise to be able to bring shed some real light onto the issues facing Taiwan and the importance of cybersecurity and the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. So to my immediate left, we have Mark Stokes. He is the executive director at the Project 2049 Institute. He is, and I consider Mark a mentor and a trusted friend, and really he is one of the leading voices on PLA cyber organizations. Mark is a 20-year U.S. Air Force veteran, served as military attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, and as senior country director for the PRC in Taiwan in the Office of Secretary of Defense. To his left, we have Euster Yu. Now, Euster is quite a rare commodity here in Washington because he, not only because he likes to show fashionably late, but he is a military guy and a diplomat as well to a degree, because he served as attaché here, as assistant attaché here, and also a technical specialist as well. And so you have that sort of triple threat there in terms of his expertise. Well, now Euster currently works as a cybersecurity consultant in Washington, D.C. After having served as a commander in the Taiwan Navy, he's generally retired. He was also assistant to the Secretary General and Deputy Secretary General of Taiwan's National Security Council, and as assistant attaché at the Taipei Economic and Cultural Representative Office in the United States. Last but not least, to his left, we have Stephen Adair. Stephen is the founder and CEO of Alexity, a security firm specializing in assisting organizations with network security monitoring, incident response, forensics, threat intelligence, and trusted security advisory. Prior to founding Alexity, Stephen was the director of cyber intelligence at Verizon, where he led and built their efforts to track emerging advanced threats with a core focus on activity related to cyber espionage. Prior to working at Verizon, Stephen ran the Cyber Threat Analysis Program within the Office of the CIO at NASA. And also, Stephen is someone I've also relied a great deal upon personally in vetting a lot of some of the emails that I've been getting over the years, and always trusted his expertise in terms of whether I'm just being way too paranoid or they are actually legitimate, phishing attempts. And so, I'd like to continue in terms of the format of our discussions is that of a more of a conversation, so that in the limited time that we have here today, that we can really drill in on some of the key issues that we are dealing with, in terms of cybersecurity and U.S. Taiwan relations. And what I'd like to do actually is actually begin with you, Stephen, because you are someone who has a very technical background. I know Yuster also has, as well as to as Mark. But your profession right now is focused on sort of the zeros and ones and the technical and technical analysis. And we're going to be talking a lot more about policies. But I think all the policies and the strategies that we will be discussing today requires a more foundation in terms of really how it really works behind the computer screen. So can you, maybe walk us through in terms of what's happening behind, the screen?
Yeah, absolutely. So not using zeros and ones to communicate this. So from a both technical and non-technical, so a lot of what's actually done, and I know some of you probably general idea, but if you use an actual, say an attack against a Taiwanese institution or defense organization, actually behind the computer, there's two aspects. You're looking at the side from the attacker, and you're looking at what the target, the victim, or the victim organization, what do they see, what does it look like? So we have a pretty good example that we can actually use to kind of answer part of this, and use kind of as a case study to walk through, no visuals, no zeros and ones, but I'll kind of describe it. And a lot of what's done is actually kind of non-technical in the sense of, visualizing it, and then it kind of gets into some technical components. So a use case I actually use, very interesting, about 4 weeks ago, just ahead of the U.S.-Taiwan Defense Industry Conference in Williamsburg, opened by U.S. Taiwan Business Council, there was a number of attendees at that conference that received a spear phishing message. Now, spear phishing is when you get an email with either an attachment or a link where the goal is to, at the end of the day, either steal your credential, the password, or more commonly, infect the computer. They want to get access, install malicious software on the computer. So in this particular instance, we had an attack against a number of people specifically attending a conference about, U.S. and Taiwan defense industry. So, we kind of have a limited number of potential people who would likely target that. And spear phishing is a little bit more advanced and very relevant to the attendees. So in this specific case, we took the, if I was standing behind the attacker, and I'll explain a little bit in a minute why we actually believe this attack, emanated out of China. If I was standing behind the attacker and watching them, a lot of what he did was pretty, not technical, but still pretty sophisticated. So this particular instance of this attack was actually conducted through, HiNet. So, actual, big ISP, big provider, potentially, I don't know, maybe it's actually the biggest in Taiwan, where they logged into the webmail. Just like you would do, you go into your webmail, just like someone in Taiwan would do, they logged into this webmail service, and then they kind of used an account that didn't actually belong to an aerospace industry in Taiwan, but kind of created the persona that it did. And they had human intelligence or some kind of other breach where they actually had a big list of the targets and people who were involved in this conference, and they sent this email purporting to be someone also involved in organizing the event. So what they did is they were, sent out an email, it's in Chinese, subjects in Chinese, bodies in Chinese, and the subject of the message was directly related to the first session of the conference. So it said, please take a look at these first session attendees, attendees, please take a look at these materials, review them, and the document that was attached was also in, Chinese name, and said, please open this. So from the attacker's perspective, they just logged in, they opened an email, they filled it out, they wrote it, and they sent it off to a bunch of people. The advanced part of that was one, the targeting, so they sent it to the correct people. Two, obviously they sent it to a relevant subject, something they were actually attending, something that was relevant to them, and that they would open. And then three, where the technical component comes in, is that what they did is they put a document file, it's actually a document inside of a zip file, but the document itself, open it up in Microsoft Word. So if you receive that message, you want to take a look, open a document, and what
the technical part of this is that document had been modified to actually have malicious code in it that would try to take advantage of a flaw in Microsoft Word. So if these people were running, you know, recipients opened this up, and they were running a slightly old version of Microsoft Word that hadn't, you know, had their patches applied, this, you know, malicious document that they modified would install software, malicious software, you know, on the victim's system that then gets the bad guy's control of their system. So the next kind of technical part of this is, you know, the way the malware works, you know, whether the end goal is the bad guys want to get access to the victim system themselves, or that victim organization, you know, their collectively their office computers, their files, you know, emails and so forth. So this malicious software uses a domain name, you know, looks up, you know, a domain owned by the bad guys, turns out it's hosted in the United States, and the bad guys can now control an infected system, you know, through that server where it's communicating with. So, you know, if this exploit's successful, the bad guys now have actual control and can do whatever they want on that end system. So, you know, take an example, they could turn on a webcam, you know, turn on the microphone and record, and take screenshots. You know, those are like scary type features. You know, in reality, they are typically not used as frequently, but they're fully capable of it. Now, with the bad guy, you know, they're sitting there with their access, they have special tools to do this. What they're typically gonna try and do next is pivot and get more access. So they can run also keyloggers, so they can start recording what's being typed on that target system. So now they can get their password. They can find out if you log into the company intranet, if you log into other webmail, if you log into your, you know, time card system. They start to expand the amount of access that they have and can kind of use, you know, to kind of further learn about the organization. But one of the big things that bad guys do is they upload additional tools that let them start to kind of pivot and move around. So their goal isn't just to stay on that one computer usually. So if that's someone that's a defense organization or a government computer, you know, they would try to start moving to other computers in the network. And once they have that kind of administrative access, you know, they can start accessing databases, they can start accessing the file shares where all, like, you know, the files and documents reside. They can access email servers where, you know, email resides. And then one of the biggest targets, what a bad guy does once they start with that first system, is they try to get to, you know, a system that has all the authentication. In Windows environments called a domain controller. So the long and short of that, in terms of, you know, not making too technical, is they're going to try and dump everyone's username and password. So their goal is to basically get access to everything. And the kind of the non-technical part at this point is they have control of that system they put the malware on. They can put malware in additional systems. But their goal is to start using normal access to the network. So once they have everyone's username and password, you know, how do you, is that, how do you work from home? Use a VPN, use a, you know, intranet. So now that they have working username and password, they can start accessing the network as if they're a system administrator or a normal employee. And that's like a little bit harder to kind of start picking up. Mm-hmm. So the other side of it, which will be a lot shorter answer, is what does that look like from the victim? Yeah. You know, I just got infected, or I'm the victim organization where they're accessing the email. The real short answer is, if it's done correctly, it's completely transparent and basically invisible. You have no idea that it occurred. So in the case that you went to a website that was infected and, you know, you have an old version of Flash, you're not going to see anything. It's all done in the background. In the case of that document that's open, you might see, you know, something close and reopen, but, you know, usually a really flawless and well-done attack is going to go completely unnoticed by the end user. So that malware getting installed, you know, unless they are caught by the antivirus, maybe that will pop up, is going to be completely transparent. They're not going to see anything. And the same goes for the organization, unless they're really keeping a close eye on their logs and other data. I mean, there are measures you can do to kind of build your defenses. It's kind of transparent.
Well, you know, I'd like to go, like, just follow on that, you know, question, actually, and just, you know, the question, the perennial question that is often, that sort of bogs sort of analysts' mind is, you know, is the attribution problem. You know, and the attribution problem is one that, you know, commonly in public discussion becomes one, a sticking point on which, you know, whether or not we, what degree of confidence are, do you have that, you know, the perpetrators are indeed the ones that are being pointed to. Maybe you can, from the more technical side, you know, can you sort of discuss about how close are we in, you know, or, you know, absolutely, where are we in that? You know,
yeah, so I definitely find the gentleman to my right and what I call true attribution in the sense of what the Intel community does. We don't focus on that. We'll do kind of like what we think it is, our association. So we track different groups that we will say, you know, this is definitely operating out of China from, you know, best of our knowledge. So we, you know, we've seen the attacks, their malware, and they have certain Chinese characters, and maybe certain malware that's only used by various threat groups that operate out of China. These aren't necessarily the smoking gun of saying I saw come out of that office in Beijing or Shanghai or something. But we see a lot of characteristics that we track back as we've seen. We've been able to work it backwards and find that historically this attack has come out of China or this ties to another piece of evidence. So we do on the threat intelligence side, we take that one indicator. We said the bad guys had a domain in that malware. Well, we can tie that domain and that IP to other things that we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years that have been historically targeting, Taiwan specifically, and then even other people in the South China Seas area. So we know that, that attack, maybe we've never seen that specific instance before, but we're able to work backwards and say, well, this is tied to this other activity. That other activity belongs to this group, that we believe to be out of China. And we can clearly say that these are the same operators. And then there's, the small common sense or, best guess, Occam's razor asking, who would want to go after certain targets or these certain specific ones and do it so consistently? I mean, I don't think Canada, being that the C ends with an A, Canada is probably not going to be like
that. Well, that's great. And this really leads well into my question for Mark here. Mark, you have been, you've published several incredibly in-depth research on PLA cyber organization, a couple of which I had the privilege of participating in, and a study that, was eventually cited by FireEye, and then also furthermore, also, I want to say directly led, but then also, contributed it to the indictment of 5 PLA officers by the Department of Justice, well, which was cited to by the same right, but that was the 61398 unit, right, and, particularly that unit. But, you've published a great deal, on this subject matter, can you give a sense of, who Taiwan, and for that matter, other targets of PRC cyber attacks and espionage are up against?
Sure, thank you, Russell. Just go back sort of to pull a thread that you threw out there. Probably around 2000, well, we were established in 2049 in January 2008, and we first started publishing. We noticed a phenomenon where after we published something, we started to get these funky emails. and they're spear phishing, some sloppy, but some can't tell if they're just regular spam. And other ones that were very well crafted. And from time to time, I actually would engage in a dialogue with whoever it is. They would go back to them and ask them, do I know you? Or say, no, I won't open the attachment, but if you can confirm that 61398 is indeed the second pair, this is way back in 2020, then maybe I'll click the attachment. But we would get there was a phenomenon. We would get these spear phishing attempts, some fairly sophisticated. Actually, there's a few responses also. One of them had sent an email, and then I didn't respond. And then I did go back, and they sent a follow-on saying, "Please open the email." And there were one of them said, I asked, "Do I know you?" And came back, and they said, "No, but you will." But one of the things that I was always curious about, because we would pass on the malware to others, because sort of a deal, do it for free. And there's technology that are able to figure out, general sense about who it is. For example, PHP1 was one of them, Comments and Nitro and these different groups. And but one of the questions I always had, because I'm kind of a structure person in terms of putting some kind of a form behind whatever it is out there. Because the image before about the hackers was sort of a group of kids going around there and just doing it for fun, sort of nationalist groups. But then they started to catch on that it may be something more to that. And so began working with Russell and others in their office to try to sort of break down one of a number of organizations, but probably the largest that may be responsible for at least part of this. And that's what used to be, this is before January of this year, the PLA General Staff Department, Third Department, and let's call that Third Department, 3PLA for short. This certainly is not the entire organization, because you also have Navy, and you have Air Force, and then you have the military regions, I guess it's pre-January. Just give a sense of what the scope and expansive nature of 3PLA, bear in mind, things have changed a bit now. 12 bureaus under 3PLA, 3 research institutes. Each one of the bureaus is roughly equivalent in stature to an army division. Not necessarily people, because a division could have anywhere between 5,000 to 2,000 people. Not necessarily in terms of people, but in terms of relative stature within the pecking order, to the protocol order, to give you a sense of how important these guys are. Of these 12 bureaus, just give a quick sampling. First bureau probably does crypto, basically making and breaking codes. Second bureau, 61398, Shanghai. At the time, it looked like they tended to focus on a lot of English linguists, but learned subsequently that anything that goes in and all communications into and out of China, generally, most of them, 90% of them go through fiber optic. And there's only five, maybe six fiber optic cable lines that go in. 60% of them are in the Shanghai area. And is it coincidental that you have the second bureau having a subordinate division or office that's somewhere adjacent to these cables? And so, of course, started looking at the other bureaus that have major cables going in and out of the country, to include up in Jinan, or up in Shandong, which generally is going to be affiliated with the fourth bureau. Third bureau has a fairly significant presence all over the country. Fifth bureau, a lot of European stuff. Sixth bureau in Wuhan has a site in Fujian as well. Seventh bureau, again, eighth bureau, ninth bureau, 10th, 11th, 12th. So a whole range of these bureaus underneath third department. Then you also have military regions. Let's say for each military region has at least one technical reconnaissance bureau. The Nanjing military region, bringing it back to Taiwan, has two technical reconnaissance bureaus, or at least used to. Nanjing MR doesn't exist anymore. But two technical reconnaissance bureaus, one headquartered in Nanjing, a lot of sites in the Shanghai area. But the key one for Taiwan would be the second technical reconnaissance bureau, headquartered in Fuzhou. Now, one of the things to bear in mind about when you mention the word cyber and sort of the stuff that I've gone over the years, I'm not sure if there's a organizationally the word cyber that's used, you know, like a cyber command. What you do have are the term technical reconnaissance, Qishu Zhenqiao. You also will have like network reconnaissance there also. But when you look at the one in Fuzhou, it's not just cyber, but the world where I'm most familiar with through history is what's called signals intelligence, which is listening on phone calls and all kinds of other things, making and breaking codes related also to jamming. And so it's kind of hard to separate breaking into networks and defending your own networks and listening on phone calls, reading text messages, reading emails that are going in and out. The organization in Fuzhou, in Fujian, this particular bureau has probably about 10 subordinate offices spread out. And you can actually go in and track each. Most of them are traditional signals intelligence. You see the big antennas. Taiwan's proximity, it's not just a cyber issue, but Taiwan's proximity also leads one to vulnerables for any phone calls that you have, going either whether it's on or off the island, certainly to the mainland, and certainly within when there's just, it's like a vacuum cleaner approach. But it's not this one TRB in Fuzhou is not the only one, so it's a pretty significant challenge that Taiwan faces. So the second part is looking at the challenge that Taiwan faces. It is, I would say, significant, equal to, if not greater than, other societies around the world. Given the status that Taiwan plays, the role that Taiwan plays in the Chinese Communist Party sort of overall strategy and what they perceived as being as an existential threat that Taiwan and its system of democracy poses. But it's significant. There have been some reports that Taiwan has been used as sort of a test bed. That when they have new malware that comes up, that Taiwan, they use it against Taiwan first and then take it to other places. I don't have a lot of evidence to back that up, but certainly there is a significant challenge that Taiwan faces. Now, having said that, arguably, and again, I'm not a technical authority, but you look at how Taiwan has done to date, arguably, apparently they're doing something right because they're still existing, they're still there. In 1999, and you shouldn't get into this a lot better than I can, but 1999, I believe, was the first time that I heard about some sort of a cyber command or some sort of a network defense system set up within the Ministry of National Defense Center, if you remember. I forgot his name. Within MND. What's that? Abe Lin. Way back a long time ago. And then starting in the early 2000s, you had cooperation that would establish between the United States and Taiwan on looking at issues like critical infrastructure protection and other initiatives. And so I will leave it there and leave it up to you to sort of take it through the rest of the way.
Yeah.
But the challenges are significant.
No, that's great, Mark. And then, thanks for helping me ask my question here. But, you know, so you said you were in government. you were in the government at the time,
a little bit.
And so, you know, can you discuss, you know, what, you know, you've got, we got the technical sort of backdrop, we got the, you know, sort of the actors, you know, that are involved. Can you give us a sense of, also a little, your sense of what the severity of the challenges that Taiwan faces in the cyber domain, and more importantly, though, is what has Taiwan done to counter this threat?
On top of the data, you just cited FireEye and other data, and also Taiwan's been dubbed as the island of APT. I also would like to point out that there are ways that people go directly into Taiwan and try to infiltrate into the network. And since it's very easy to, these days, for Chinese to come to Taiwan and set up companies, it's getting more and more serious. Even potentially would have the ability to social network into air-gapped systems. One example I like to point out was the recent CDO and MailNet breach. It took place in Jinmen, a small station, and a very young girl, a young officer who had previously visited Nanjing twice within 1 year, got recruited into CDO, started working there, and she was caught plugging in a, first she said iPhone, and then she said some USB drive in there. So that's another kind of threat. I think it's unpreventable. And since the close network, the administration would think this is close network, so they're less cautious about timely patching their systems, because it's hard to patch them unless the guys go individually to patch other systems. So normally they're late. So that's another kind of threat that you guys have not mentioned. And for Taiwan, what has Taiwan been doing? I think from, as Mark mentioned, in this military part and then this executive yuan part, before August 1 of this year, there was this Xingzheng Yuan Sitong Anquan Hui Bao, that's Information and Communication Security kind of board, where all agencies would report any kind of intrusion or suspicion, and then they would send out people to take care of that and issue guidelines and warnings to all government agencies. Starting April 1st, they set up this Zizanchu Information Security Division at the UI. So I guess they're giving it more power to start pushing out laws to regulate private sectors that may have anything to do with infrastructures. So that's the improvement thing. And also the MND has been talking about setting this fourth army based on DPP's election campaign blue book. 6,000 people and headed by a four general. Okay, and yeah, that's what they've been doing. Anything more? Well, no.